Any guesses as to what the top issue for Super Tuesday voters was?
It's the economy, stupid.
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Bob Moon. This is the Marketplace Midday Update, our podcast from Marketplace.org. It's Wednesday, March 7th.
Coming up, we're really not calling you stupid. It really is the economy. That's the number one issue.
Also, News Corporation's troubles cross the pond.
And Miss Seattle is in some hot water for hating Seattle.
Those stories and more just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Don't miss the numbers, the news, and Kai's final note. Subscribe to the Marketplace podcast. Find it on iTunes or online at marketplace.org/podcasts.
Well, let's do the other kind of numbers right now. Some numbers from Super Tuesday. Mm-hmm. 6 states won by Mitt Romney, 3 states won by Rick Santorum, 1 state won by Newt Gingrich. And the number one issue for voters in state after state yesterday, the economy. Here's political scientist Larry Sabato from the University of Virginia.
The economy is foremost. It has been virtually from the beginning. But what's interesting is in a year when most Americans are most interested in the economy, it doesn't seem to be enough to carry a candidate to the Republican nomination.
Well, let's talk about Super Tuesday now with Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman. Good morning.
Hi, Bob.
So how does this focus on the economy play out amongst the field?
Well, you know, it cuts sort of all ways depending on where you sit in the economy. Romney polls best among higher income urban and suburban people. Santorum and Gingrich do better among lower income and rural Republicans. That may say something about Romney's own background that voters don't identify with him if they're not in that income bracket. Santorum has appealed to people he identifies with. That's Rust Belt working class.
And what about after the primary in the general election?
Well, you know, 6 months ago, analysts would have said the economy, how it's doing, benefits Republicans and hurts the president. Now, maybe not so much. The economy's getting better. So it's harder to make the case on everything from job growth to the deficit. Stan Collender is a budget analyst in Washington.
When the economy's bad, people say it's the budget's fault. When inflation is roaring or soaring, it's the budget's fault, and we got to do something about the deficit. But when people are feeling better about their employment prospects and compensation prospects and their home prices, concern about the deficit tends to go down.
Well, it would seem, though, Mitchell, that Romney is still the front runner today. Is he going to continue to push his experience in the economy, his private business experience?
Well, you know, that is certainly his strongest message. He keeps coming back to it. You know, against Gingrich, Santorum, and Ron Paul, not to mention President Obama. But Stan Collender says in this particular political moment, because of the financial crash and the role that some financial executives played in it, this isn't necessarily a slam dunk for Romney either.
There is a lot of belief in the private sector of the United States. I mean, it's in our DNA. You know, ultimately, it's going to come down to, is Obama a good manager versus Romney? Would he be a good manager?
You know, and there's still plenty of economy still to go before November. I mean, you know, gas prices are going up. Europe and Greece clearly aren't out of the woods. Job growth has been solid, and we just got some encouraging numbers this morning on that from ADP. But look, you know, it still could stall again. We'll see on Friday how it was going in February.
Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman, thanks.
You're welcome.
Well, if the number one issue for voters was the economy, let's talk about the economy. Jobs, to be specific. The payroll processing company ADP said this morning that the private sector added 216,000 jobs last month, beating expectations. For more on this, let's bring in our regular Wednesday guest, Josh Brown of Fusion Analytics. He is with us now from New York. Good morning.
Good morning.
So what do you think of this? Another good month for job creation.
Well, this is not the official number. Keep in mind, this is private payrolls from ADP, which typically aligns, but it's not perfect. But yeah, I mean, there's nothing really not to like here. 216,000 jobs, which is basically in line. And within that number, you saw small businesses hiring, which is really important. Small businesses are a big source of new jobs in America.
And, of course, as you mentioned, we're waiting for the big Labor Department report on Friday for the month of February. What about the people who are being left behind, Josh, who are not getting jobs right now?
You know, it's tough, and it's actually pretty industry-specific. And I hate to sound callous, and certainly, you know, Wall Street is seeing its share of layoffs as well. But if after 5 years you consider yourself as being left behind, at a certain point it's not just the economy, it's a little bit you. So I think there are regions in the country that are doing better. There are certain industries versus others that are doing better. And at a certain point, you really have to reinvent yourself.
But Josh, I mean, some people will hear that and say, wait a minute, I can't move for a job. My house is underwater. I've got a family. What am I supposed to do?
Nobody said this was easy. One of the problems with a post-credit crisis balance sheet recession type scenario is that you've got this huge overhang of debt everywhere. People aren't hiring. We don't get that same snapback that you get from a regular recession. So again, nobody said this was easy, but unfortunately, sometimes that's just what the economy throws you. Some people adapt and some don't. I hate to sound callous, but at a certain point, you've got to really wake up and say, these jobs may not be coming back.
Josh Brown of Fusion Analytics, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Well, now to a looming economic threat, there's a possibility that some of Greece's private creditors won't accept big losses on their investments by a deadline tomorrow night. Their debt forgiveness was a key part of a deal agreed to last month to keep Greece out of default and Europe out of chaos.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard is with us now from London with more on this. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Jeremy.
Well, I thought this was a done deal and that Greece's private lenders had agreed to it.
It's never a done deal when it comes to the Greek debt crisis, Jeremy. The broad outline of a deal was agreed between the Greek government and this body called the International Finance Institute. It represents most of Greece's private sector creditors. But the creditors themselves have to agree the debt swap before it can go ahead, and it seems that a number of them are still holding out.
But why are they holding out, though, Stephen? I mean, aren't they worried about the consequences that are being talked about right now? Default, banking crisis, real trouble in Europe.
Well, some of the big banks have signed up to the deal, but it's believed that a bunch of hedge funds are refusing. Now, one theory, these investors hold these so-called credit default swaps, insurance policies that will pay out in full if Greece defaults. So it may be in their narrow self-interest to see a default, however much damage that does to the euro and financial markets generally. I suspect, though, Jeremy, we won't really know what's going on until tomorrow's deadline for the debt swap deal has passed.
We'll have to keep waiting to see. And Stephen, before I let you go, are you and your fellow Brits following the Super Tuesday results?
Avidly. It's leading the news here.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London. Thanks a lot.
Okay, Jeremy.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
Today, Apple is announcing something new, which has touched off the rumor mill that Apple just thrives on. Word is it'll show off its newest iPad. Finally, something to take the spotlight off the company for labor conditions at its suppliers in China and the heat over the lack of American jobs it creates. As Marketplace's Jennifer Collins reports, Apple wants consumers to think different.
We're talking about Apple here, so there aren't many details. But we can be pretty sure of one thing. Whatever the company unveils, it will have this printed on it.
Designed by Apple in California.
Joel Spolsky is a software developer. He says that statement has appeared on Apple products for at least a decade, right next to the one that says, assembled in China.
It's brilliant. You know, instead of thinking about rows and rows of unhappy children on an assembly line, you're actually thinking of California.
Hello, I'm a Mac.
And I'm a PC.
California, here we come.
You get the idea. Thing is, Apple's had a hard time lately getting people's minds off its foreign assembly lines. The company says it supported or created around 500,000 jobs in the U.S. Analyst Michael Morgan is with ABI Research.
More of the jobs they're creating are overseas, but the revenues are probably landing in the U.S.
And if the third iPad lives up to its predecessors, those revenues are likely to keep on coming. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Trouble may have jumped the pond for Rupert Murdoch. At the same time his British media company is taking heat for a bribery scandal, comes word that U.S.-based News Corp is under investigation for the actions of a one-time subsidiary. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler explains.
A law enforcement official confirms the FBI is investigating News Corp for alleged bribery by a former subsidiary. Employees at the Russian billboard company are suspected of bribing officials to get signs placed. News Corp declined to comment. If the company is found to have violated American laws against bribery overseas, it could threaten News Corp's U.S. broadcast licenses. Steve Efros is a media consultant.
Those are issues that could be raised in a license renewal proceeding here.
But he says the chances are slim that the Federal Communications Commission would revoke the licenses. Still, the fallout of these investigations could have other repercussions. Porter Bibb is with MediaTek Capital Partners.
It also could lead eventually to the breaking up of News Corp.
Bibb says some News Corp shareholders want to split the company, separating sports and entertainment from news and publishing. The bribery scandal could provide the leverage needed to orchestrate a breakup. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
One of the biggest items in any state budget is Medicaid, which pays for health care for the poor. States share the cost with the federal government, but in these tough economic times, some states are getting picky about what they pay for when it comes to Medicaid. And doctors who don't want to work for free are pushing back. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports on one state at the center of this fight, Washington.
Washington State is set to refuse payment for certain emergency room visits starting next month. It's come up with a list of about 500 ER diagnoses that hospitals won't be allowed to bill Medicaid for. It includes things like pregnancy tests, urinary tract infections, and other minor things that Medicaid patients go to an emergency room for instead of seeing their regular doctors. Maybe they don't have a primary care doc. These patients are in the ER so much they're nicknamed frequent flyers. Dr. Jeff Thompson is Washington State's chief medical officer.
It will be something that will be new and innovative, but we think we can do it.
For example, Washington State won't pay for minor sprains anymore.
I mean, if somebody breaks a ligament or breaks a bone, we'll pay for that.
But ER docs don't know if there's a ligament tear or broken bone without an expensive x-ray. And if it's not a bad sprain, the hospital will get stuck with the bill. And it's not like hospitals can turn anyone away. Nathan Schlicker is a doctor at St. Joseph Medical Center in Tacoma, Washington.
Well, remember that we can't legally keep anyone out of the ER. Once they ask for emergency care, we're required to see, screen, and stabilize them.
So far, Washington is the only state that's going to refuse to fund ER treatment for Medicaid patients with minor injuries. But other states are also watching the bottom line, because Medicaid is a joint federal-state effort, and the feds only pay for about half of the state's Medicaid costs on average. So states are slashing their Medicaid payments to doctors and hospitals. Alan Weil studies state health issues at the nonpartisan National Academy for State Health Policy.
And we are seeing state after state making sometimes 5%, sometimes 10% cuts in payment rates under the Medicaid program.
Weil says most states are still footing the bill for all Medicaid ER visits. They're slashing their payments, but they are still paying. Weil says they're watching Washington State's emergency room experiment closely. If it works, maybe they'll try it. In Washington, D.C., I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Well, staying in Washington State, Bob, let's go to Seattle, where there is a controversy going on right now involving the woman who just won the Miss Seattle pageant.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, back in December, she tweeted, quote, "Ugh, can't stand cold, rainy Seattle and the annoying people."
This is Miss Seattle?
This is Miss Seattle. And she says now that she didn't mean that, but when you look back at some of her other tweets, she also said, quote, "Ew, I am seriously hating Seattle right now." Now, in fairness to Miss Seattle, she did just move from Arizona, where she was, by the way, Miss Phoenix in 2010.
She has a future as a diplomat.
Well, that's right. But she may also have some adjustment to the weather to do first.
Mm-hmm. Now to our Marketplace Midday Extra. Netflix may be turning the tables, or the channels, if you will, on the cable TV business. The video rental company has previously bargained for the rights to stream cable shows. Now Reuters reports the head of Netflix has quietly met with big cable TV companies to talk about adding Netflix offerings to their cable programming. The news comes as Netflix is launching its own original shows, the first in 8-episode series called Lilyhammer. Stephen Van Zandt stars as a reform mobster who's relocated to Norway, and we caught up with him in New York. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure, Bob.
You famously starred in The Sopranos. Did you ever expect to come back, star in, and now executive produce another show like this?
You never know in this world. you learn to expect the unexpected. One thing for sure I've learned that, you know, all the stuff you're really working on very hard, that stuff doesn't seem to happen. But it's out of nowhere, these things will come at you. And, you know, you got to be flexible enough to say, you know what, I wasn't planning on playing a gangster again, not this soon, but this is just too good an idea.
And this is a new concept that Netflix threw at you, an original series launching all at once online so you can stream it whenever you're ready to watch. How's it doing so far?
Well, it's doing remarkably well. And it was just very impressive to me that they would choose this as their first original programming, because it really says something about the company to pick this quirky show with subtitles as their first original programming. I thought it was an amazing statement. It bodes well for this. You know, we hear this conversation constantly about globalization and the global marketplace. And, you know, in a few years, companies like Netflix will be one-stop shopping for the world, perhaps. And then you add into that mix a foreign person and a domestic show, because it really was made originally for Norwegian TV. Mm-hmm. And we experimented with this idea of, you know, the lead character speaking English. The premise is that he understands Norwegian but doesn't speak it. And because they all speak English, you know, it seemed totally believable, and just ended up working remarkably well, because even for people who don't like subtitles, all of a sudden you're in Norway because this one guy is speaking English, and you're kind of experiencing the show the way he does, you know.
I wonder, how do we judge how the show is doing online when there's really very little to compare it to?
Well, that's a good point. I'm sure they have their own, their own metrics, their own sort of... way of measuring things, just like HBO when they started. You know, that was sort of a mystery. With them, though, what's nice also is you're getting away from the panic of the opening weekend thing, which is so prevalent in the movie business and even the music business to some extent now.
I read one account that suggested you weren't convinced it was wise to put all the episodes up for streaming all at once. What was some of the debate around that?
Well, you know, I'm an old school guy, you know, so I'm like a little bit, I'm always a little bit, you know, your natural inclination is to question new stuff. You know, that's just, you know, how it is. So I thought, you know, well, in the old days, you know, you get a cumulative sort of word of mouth, and just the simple fact that I worked a year and a half on the thing and to have it spill out in one day, was a little bit, I'm like, can't we pretend we worked a little harder on this, you know? But then, but Ted Sarandos, who, the head of content over there, is very accurately pointed out, you know what, it's just like releasing an album, which I hadn't really thought of, but of course it is a very accurate analogy. You know, you work hard on that for a year, year and a half, and stick that out in one day, what's the difference, right?
So is this, as they say, the future of television, or more to the point, is this going to be destroying traditional TV as we know it?
I wouldn't use the word destroying as much as just an evolution of it that is already taking place. I started, you know, once they told me they're going to do that, I started asking people, you know, what are their viewing habits these days? Because I don't really watch TV, tell you the truth, very often. And turns out, most of the young people in my office watch shows that way. Even the regular network shows, they'll tape the whole season and then watch, you know, whatever it is, 2, 3, 4 at a time, or have a marathon and watch it all at once. And so this is actually happening. So I think Netflix is just a little bit ahead of everybody else in picking up on what the actual younger viewing habits seem to be.
So Netflix seems happy. Is there going to be a season two?
Well, yeah, they want one. You know, it's a little bit complicated. I have this other thing I got to do called a rock and roll tour at the moment. So kind of see where we can fit it in. It may take a minute. You know, we may be waiting for the second season for a little while, unfortunately.
Speaking of your musical side, I have to ask you, when are we going to hear a new solo release out of Steven Van Zandt?
Well, I have no plans for that. I really, you know, interest at the moment is going more towards scoring film and TV. I almost scored Lilyhammer. I did write the theme song, and some of the music cues you'll hear throughout the 8 episodes are mine. But scoring is kind of where my head is at the moment. I love the idea of doing that. So probably the next few things for me musically will be in that world. I did do the music for David Chase's new movie. It's called Not Fade Away, and it's but more in the it's a little bit of a different sort of music supervision in that it's about a young rock and roll band. So I had to design what they sounded like from like 62 to 68, and that was a lot of fun.
That must have been a reach, huh?
Yeah, it's a couple of years before my time, but not much.
Stephen Van Zandt, thanks for talking to us, and good luck with this.
Well, thank you very much, Bob. Really, good talking to you.
You know, Jeremy, I confess I love donuts.
Maybe, who doesn't?
Maybe even more than Homer Simpson. But I'm afraid this is where I draw the line. The head of Dunkin' Donuts tells Reuters the company is trying new things as it looks to expand globally. So it's aiming its latest savory sensation at the Chinese market, where consumers are very fond of the other white meat.
Pork.
Mm-hmm. So introducing shredded pork donuts.
Oh, gosh, that does not sound very good.
They do have different tastes in Asia. You can already get Pringles chips, I don't know if you know this, over there in grilled shrimp and seaweed flavors. I wouldn't recommend those for breakfast, though.
Absolutely not. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Bob Moon. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.